from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, new research is helping to explain why dieting does not lead to long-term weight loss in the vast majority of people and may even lead to weight gain. A key reason for this, some researchers say, is that our bodies employ mechanisms to keep our weight within a certain range or a set point. We'll discuss the effect of dieting on metabolism and the relationship between health and weight. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. You can't lose weight on a diet. It isn't willpower, it's neuroscience, and you can't and shouldn't fight back. So writes neuroscientist Sandra Amit in the New York Times. New research, in fact, affirms not only that diets don't work and do not lead to weight loss, but they may also not even be beneficial as long thought for health gains. And we're going to discuss all this in this opening Forum hour, and let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Sandra Amit is here in studio with us, again, neuroscientist and science writer. Her forthcoming book is Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. And welcome to the program. Glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Also want to welcome Katie Ferraro back to the Forum program. She's a registered dietitian, assistant clinical professor at UC San Francisco School of Nursing, and joins us this morning from San Diego. Welcome back, Katie Ferraro.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both with us. And Sandra Amit, I'm going to begin with you. And let's see if we can get some of this research down here for listeners. You have a low-calorie diet. First of all, it's not sustainable. And secondly, it really comes down from all this neuroscience that you've done to metabolism and set point.
So everybody has had experiences with themselves or with other people around them. We know that it's hard to lose weight and that if you succeed in losing weight, it's really especially hard to keep it off. And the reason for that is because the brain has a coordinated defensive response against weight loss that is trying to make people gain back the weight that they've lost in order to keep them within a weight range that the brain thinks is correct for them. Now, your doctor may not agree that that's your ideal weight range, but
your body tells you otherwise.
Your brain has its own ideas about that. And what happens when you get below that range is that you get hungry, you find eating more rewarding than you did before, and your metabolism drops so that your body is actually burning less energy through physical activity than it used to before.
And burning fewer calories.
Yeah.
So it also produces more hunger because of the hormones. You find eating more rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Brain imaging studies show that people who are below their defended weight range have stronger reward responses to food.
And after about 5 years, I mean, this is the research now, the dieters find that they gain back what they've lost. I mean, even if they're on what they think is a pretty steady diet, like, by the way, I've been on for about 5 years or so. I won't get into that maybe if it's of interest. But this is something that, again, biology dictates as well. I mean, you're talking about neuroscience, but really our bodies.
So on average, people reach the lowest weight that they're going to hit on a diet sometime between 6 months and a year after they start. And then they gradually gain the weight back. And by 5 years out, most people have regained the weight. And some people have actually overshot and ended up heavier than they were when they started.
So this Biggest Loser show that a lot of people watch, contradictory in terms of what really happens after in the aftermath, yeah?
I want to see the Big Loser reunion show.
You're going to see a lot of obese people.
You are going to see a lot of people who weigh a lot more than they did when the show ended.
It's also in the New York Times piece that you did, you told your own story, and I thought you were very forthcoming about that. You talked about going on diets from the age of 11 and said kind of candidly and humorously that you could have used a fashion advisor because you put a picture of yourself in there, or the New York Times did. But at this point, and for the last 6 years, you do not diet, and you've used exercise and meditation largely. Is that right?
Yeah. I stopped dieting in 2010. It was my New Year's resolution that year. And I just said to myself, okay, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to try that for a year and see what happens. And instead, I concentrated on eating when I'm hungry, stopping when I'm full, and getting regular exercise. And it turned out that my weight actually dropped a little bit. And it's been stable ever since.
I know there are a lot of people wondering, what do we define as a diet? I mean, you know, there's all these kind of diets out there and so forth. In fact, it's extraordinary how much money is spent on weight reduction. We can get into that perhaps in the course of this hour. But maybe you could give us a sense of what we mean in a generic way when we talk about diet.
Yeah, different people mean different things. What I mean is applying your willpower to the task of losing weight on purpose.
Doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
Diets don't work. I remember a book by that title. But also, I think it's important to realize, as you point out, that dieting can also be very stressful and can lead to binge eating, what you're defining as dieting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so every long-term study where you look at people's characteristics and then you follow them over a period of 1 to 15 years, depending on the study, every one of those studies has shown that people who diet end up heavier at the end of follow-up than people who were not dieting at the beginning of the study. That's true in men and women. It's true from childhood through middle age. It's true across different ethnic groups. And we should get into some more details about why it might be true. But nobody has ever found that on population average, dieting leads to long-term weight loss.
Again, Sandra Amit is a neuroscientist and a science writer and has a book coming out soon called Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequence of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. Katie Ferraro is with us from San Diego. She's a registered dietitian, assistant clinical professor at UC San Francisco School of Nursing. And Katie Ferraro, yet nevertheless, people associate dieting, as we're defining it here, with getting your cholesterol down, getting your blood sugar down. I mean, things that are necessary and healthy.
Yes, there's certainly a link between increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, other chronic disease with overweight and obesity. But you know, as Sandra said, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach for everyone. And what we teach our students at UCSF is, you know, if you talk about going on a diet, we try not to use that term even, because there's the inherent understanding that going on a diet means, well, eventually I'm going to go off of a diet. So if you just think of a short-term approach to changing the way you eat to lose weight for a high school reunion or another event, that's not really looking at the larger issue, which is to make real changes, we need to see longer-term commitments.
But the fact is that certain kinds of diets, particularly when it comes to, I mean, I have diabetes and I've been trying to avoid carbs and sugar, and it means better health, doesn't it? If you can sustain it. The difficulty is sustaining it. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, we're talking about a $20 billion industry, the weight loss industry, and there's lots of confusion, and what works for you to help bring your blood sugar down might not work for another individual. So it's hard to say across the board that, you know, X, Y, or Z diet does or doesn't work, because for some people it might work, but as Sandra pointed out, most of these are short-term fixes, and the data doesn't suggest that there's really any long-term benefit to dieting, that there is not one diet that has been proven to help people lose weight, but more importantly, keep it off, because that's the key. Anyone can lose 10 pounds for a high school reunion, but can you keep it off? That's what we really seek to understand.
Well, there's also research that suggests that maybe it's not such a bad idea as I thought it was. My mother used to say to me, are you full? Are you full? You know, meaning that I feel full. And then it came under a lot of scrutiny. A lot of people said you shouldn't eat until you're full. But maybe and as we understand things now, it's not necessarily a bad idea to eat until you're full.
Well, yes, if you look at the way, if you ever watch a child eat, I have little kids, and kids inherently know when they're full, right? They turn their head away, the baby turns their head away from the breast, or they push back from the high chair. We as adults have spent so much time learning to override those satiety cues. Think about Thanksgiving. You can eat meat, meat, even though you know you're not hungry. So there is something to be said about retraining our brain to learn about and listen to our hunger and satiety cues. We're basically reteaching ourselves to act the way we did when we were a baby, to inherently know, hey, I'm actually full and I don't need any more food. But that's hard to do in our 24-hour food environment.
It certainly is. In fact, let me defer to our neuroscientist, Sandra Emmett. I mean, how do you begin to rewire yourself in the way she's suggesting or train yourself?
So that's where mindful eating comes into the picture. There are a number of formal programs for doing that that have been research tested, but it's also perfectly possible to do it on your own, which is what I did. I just committed that for that year, 2010, every time I was about to eat something, I just had to stop and close my eyes and check in with my body and see how my stomach was feeling. Was I hungry? Was there something else going on? Was I bored or avoiding something or irritated? Or was I hungry? And usually this process works best if you start by just noticing for a week or two before you try to change anything.
Katie Ferraro, you were kind of alluding to all that's done on, one attempt or another. I mean, we've got obesity. Over a third of U.S. adults are categorized as obese. So we're talking about billions of dollars that are spent on drugs and dieting. And if this research that we're talking about is correct, people are spending all this money or maybe wasting their money, or they're working against their own biology?
I think both of those points are correct. Most of what we spend in the diet industry is a waste of money. You know, eating properly and exercising, that takes a lot of hard work. You kind of can't buy your way out of this, you know, massive amount of calories that we are consuming on a regular basis. So, yes, I would argue, and most practitioners would argue, I believe, that most of the money people do spend on diet books and drugs and surgeries and supplements, they're really not addressing the underlying effect, which is the relationship between our brain and our weight, and that these certainly are interlinked areas of our biology.
And what to do from your perspective about, Sandra mentions mindfulness and mindful eating, and anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, we teach our practitioners that you need to come back to food, that so often people are looking for a supplement or a quick fix. And we encourage our practitioners to teach patients the importance of actually knowing how to prepare food. So many people don't even, you know, bring their own lunch to work. They rely on someone else to make food for them. They rely on someone else to basically bring in hundreds, sometimes thousands of extra calories a day that we don't need. So we're really working at the practitioner level to help people reconnect with food. And a lot of that is tied into what Sandra was mentioning, the mindfulness side of things, which is, okay, am I really hungry? Am I really full? Is this something I need or something I want? And to acknowledge those different feelings, and that we certainly do have an emotional connection to our food.
And Sandra Emmett, if I could get back to, the whole question of obesity. There was a study which I found fascinating, I'm sure you're familiar with, back in 2006 with elite athletes in Finland. They were competing, and they were obviously very weight conscious because of the sports they were involved in. They were three times more likely to be obese, though, by the time they were age 60.
Yeah, so that comes back to this question of whether dieting actually causes weight gain or whether it's just correlated with it, because people who feel themselves to be at risk of weight gain are more likely to go on diets. And so the interesting thing about people who compete in weight-conscious sports like boxing or wrestling, where they have to make a particular weight class for their competition, those people are notorious for going on very aggressive diets. But it's presumably not because they have a genetic tendency toward weight gain that's particularly stronger than the rest of us. So the fact that boxers and wrestlers were three times more likely to be obese at age 60 than their peers who participated in other sports for Finland argues that it's reasonable to think that dieting may actually be a cause of obesity.
So it gets down to that same question that I asked Katie Ferraro, or maybe I'm being rhetorical here. It's crazy to spend a lot of money on weight loss products. Huge amounts of money are spent, billions.
Yeah, I think we're really grabbing this problem from the wrong end. So there is no coordinated brain response trying to keep you from exercising. There is no coordinated brain response trying to keep you from eating more vegetables. There is no coordinated brain response trying to keep you from learning how to manage your stress better. why in the world are we focusing on the one outcome measure that we know is going to be opposed dramatically by our physiology? Why is that the correct thing to concentrate on?
Katie Farrow, do taste buds play any role in this from your perspective as a dietitian?
I'm sorry, do what play any role?
Taste buds, what we like to eat as opposed to, what we should be eating or what we ought to be eating.
Well, certainly the taste bud issue is a learned behavior as well. You know, we gravitate towards these very salty, very sugary, very fatty foods that are in our diet because they do tend to be cheaper. And if we introduce them earlier in life, we know that children develop an affinity for those foods. So, and some of this has to do with the process of behavior change and kind of retraining our taste buds. You can actually retrain your taste buds to not like salt as much if you do just as short of a 6-week period where you cut out salt and you went back to eating the way you used to eat, you would be abhorred by the saltiness of your food. So some of this certainly is a learned behavior. Some of it has to do with the proliferation, though, of all these high-fat, high-salt foods in our diet.
Hasn't salt come in for some new reckoning, though? I mean, not as deleterious as once thought. That was my impression.
Yes, but if you look at the foods that are so high in salt, it's not the salt shaker that's the real culprit. It's all the fast foods and the packaged foods and the processed foods that we eat. It's everywhere around us. It's certainly not good for us to be having at such high levels. Whether or not it's as deleterious as one thought, it's kind of splitting hairs. At the end of the day, we shouldn't be eating a lot of those foods that have a lot of salt added to them. The fruits, the vegetables, whole grains. Those foods are naturally low in sodium, and that works from a weight management standpoint as well because they tend to be lower in calories.
What about, we're talking about willpower here, but what about something like bariatric surgery? I mean, do people tend to, you know, keep the weight off, either of you, when they have bariatrics? You're nodding your head. Yes, Sandra Hammond.
Yeah, so bariatric surgery is not the same as weight loss induced by lifestyle changes. I'm not a fan of bariatric surgery. It's got a lot of scary side effects, but it is pretty clear that it does actually change the brain's defended weight range and reduce the set point in a way that lasts a long time. And the people who, a year out from bariatric surgery, people who have lost a lot of weight don't generally show the metabolic suppression that we see in people who have reduced their weight to a similar extent by dieting.
I'm going to open the phone lines because I know there's a lot of listener interest and an opportunity for you to ask questions of our guests. New research, again, helping to explain why dieting does not lead to long-term weight loss, and the vast majority of people may even lead to weight gain. And a key reason for this, some research say, is that our bodies employ mechanisms to keep our weight within a certain range or set point, as was just mentioned by Sandra Hammond. And we're discussing the effects of dieting on metabolism, relationship between health and weight, and certainly want to hear from you. I know many of you have questions or comments and you're invited to join the program. Our toll-free number is available right now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. That number is 866-733-6786. And just as I expected, lots of calls coming in. But again, join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to be part of the program with your questions or comments. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And we've got a question here, Katie Ferraro, about fat cells. Like to know if you have thoughts about this or perhaps some knowledge on it. Listener writes, I recall reading in the past that those who are overweight before adulthood have more fat cells than those who become overweight as adults. If that is accurate, could the number of fat cells affect the ability to keep off weight after dieting, such as through the actions of the hormone ghrelin, which increases hunger?
Well, as Sandra mentioned, with bariatric surgery, we do see some data to suggest that there are hormonal changes. People who've had bariatric surgery, the cells of their stomach that produce that hormone you mentioned, ghrelin, that's the one that makes you feel hungry, but that seems to be suppressed in those people. So in certain populations, ghrelin may play a role, but it's important to keep in mind that when you lose weight, your fat cells shrink in both size, but they don't shrink in number. So when you gain weight, your fat cells increase in size and number. And so when we look at people who are on these lifetime cycles of yo-yo dieting, you lose 10 pounds, but then you gain back 15, we see not only changes in the biology, but also changes in the metabolism, in the sense that your body gets confused. Is it starving? Is it not starving? And that you could be, and as Sandra intimated, doing more of harm, that dieting might actually be leading to weight gain in that regard, because you are messing with the metabolic set point, and also changes in your biology and your fat cells as a result from all of these yo-yo diets that you're on, sometimes for years, and in some patients that we even see for decades of yo-yo dieting.
Again, Katie Ferraro is with us from San Diego. She's a registered dietitian and assistant clinical professor at UC San Francisco School of Nursing. Let me go right to your calls. And Harvey, we begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Great show. I noticed that I had a hunch, and I went to Google, and the hunch was is that the rise of obesity was correlated with or with genetically modified foods, and many, many articles came up, and I suggest you go to Google and read obesity and genetically modified foods, and the answer is organics, because organic food is not genetically modified, and I feel that by eating organic foods that you will help to reduce this obesity. So no wonder they keep the genetically modified foods. They don't want to display it on the foods, because I think it is linked to obesity.
Well, I'm wondering, Katie Ferraro, if you have some thoughts about that. I'm also thinking about programs we've done with your colleague Bob Lustig, who feels that obesity is part of what's being put in the way of sugar and processed fat and all the rest of it into our foods. But want to comment, Katie?
Well, as we teach our patients, when it comes to organic food, organic junk food is still junk food. So there's all these great surveys that show if you ask a typical American, is an organic food healthier, they inherently think yes. But, you know, there's organic tortilla chips, organic ice cream, organic cookies. These are just organic versions of the foods that you realize you shouldn't be eating that much of to begin with. So we encourage our patients, you know, don't be tricked by thinking that all organic foods are necessarily healthy. At the end of the day, I don't want to discourage anyone from eating fruits and vegetables. If they're conventionally prepared, that's much better than having an organic cookie or ice cream bar.
Here's Scott. Scott, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Just first impression is when I hear someone say, I'm going on a diet, I immediately think I'm going on the wagon. And then when they fall off of their diet, they fall off of the wagon. And I just wanted to get your guest's impressions of similar addictions with, you know, alcohol and drugs and food. And secondly, the mindfulness component, I'm very encouraged by that in society. We're all into this meditation trend, and it's cool now, and that's great. But I also see an opportunity in the future for technology to increase our awareness and increase our mindfulness by the fact that it's going to become more nuanced and kind of observing our patterns and our behaviors.
Scott, I'm coming up on a break here, and I think you're right about technology possibly changing things. But I'd like to hear from Sandra before we go to a break here. I mean, addiction to alcohol and addiction to food, similarities neurologically?
They're certainly not equivalent. Most people who are obese are not addicted to food. There probably are a subset of binge eaters who could reasonably be described as having some characteristics of addiction, but it's pretty complicated.
We'll continue. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about research that really affirms and confirms that diets don't lead to weight loss or necessarily health gains. We're talking with Katie Ferraro, who is a registered dietitian and assistant clinical professor at UC San Francisco School of Nursing, and Sandra Ammett, who's here with us in studio, a neuroscientist and science writer who actually covered this for the New York Times, an article which has certainly evoked a great deal of response. And she has a book coming out called Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences, make that consequence of our obsession with weight loss. And we are bringing you into the conversation with your questions or comments. And we invite you to participate toll free. Again, you can do that at 866-733-6786 or by emailing us forum@kqed.org or posting questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Here's Vicky, who tweets, listening to KQED Forum discuss New York Times diet articles, conclusion, nothing works, don't bother. Well, that's not really what you're saying here, Sandra Ammett.
No, what I'm saying is try something that does work. We know that exercise improves health, whether or not it causes you to lose weight, We know that eating more vegetables improves health. What we also know is that dieting generally doesn't.
So you make the choices.
That's right.
Well, speaking of those choices, let me go to Katie Ferraro and a question from Paul. What should we consider to be our set point? It's much easier for me to endure a hungry feeling than the pangs of sciatica, and losing weight has stopped my sciatica.
Yes, well, when each individual has their own set point, and I think you can probably speak to that in your own personal situation, you have to work so hard in some cases to get to a certain weight that another person of your similar height and activity level might not struggle as much with. So we do need to keep in mind that we're all tasked with our own individual biology, and a weight that works for you might not be the weight that works for me.
I'm also, just a quick question before I go to our more callers that I'm going to put to you, if I may, Katie Ferraro, from Carol, who writes, but obesity isn't a natural phenomenon, right?
It's certainly not natural to consume the level of calories that most Americans do and to have such a sedentary lifestyle. You know, as human beings, we're supposed to be out moving around, eating fruits and vegetables, et cetera, but we've created this lifestyle where we eat artificial food and, to be honest, we sit down all day. So that's not a natural lifestyle as well, and it leads to these unnatural outcomes of overweight and obesity, which, as you mentioned, afflict two-thirds of the adult population in this country today.
You remember before we went to the break, we had someone who wanted to know about the connection between, for example, addiction to alcohol and addiction to food. Looking at another tweet, which sort of follows a similar motif, this is Jay who tweets, a lack of human connection is now associated with chemical addiction. Is there data regarding connection with food addiction or obesity? Katie Ferraro?
As Sandra mentioned, there is certainly the case where binge eaters may be a population who do have some sort of addiction to food. In our experience, especially working with groups and individuals on a one-on-one basis, a lot of times we have to explore the underlying problem of why are people eating so much, and is it necessarily an addiction? Are they emotional eaters? There's lots of underlying causes that can cause or propel one to eat more calories than they probably should and to maybe not exercise as much as they should.
And we'll go to more of your phone calls. Let me go next to Michael, who's joining us from Oakland this morning. Michael, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
So I certainly agree that it's very important to understand the neurobiological basis of why people get motivated to return to their set point. I think, though, Dr. Arnott is really doing people who are obese a disservice by suggesting that dieting is just impossible and inevitably fails. It is true that on a population average, within about 5 years, on average, dieters have regained the weight they lost. But within that average, there's about 20 to 25% of people who maintain all or nearly all of the weight they lost in the first place. And the key is to understand what's going on with that 25% of people versus the rest of the population and how we can exploit the neurobiological basis of defending the set point to get everyone into that range instead of just the few who manage to develop the skills or who have the differential neurology that lets them keep that weight down after they've lost it.
Michael, thank you for that, though. I think, Sandra Emmett, if I'm not mistaken, 25% is pretty high, isn't it? So much lower
than
that.
I'm only familiar with one study that found 25% of maintained weight loss, and that was using a criterion of 1 year of 10% below the person's highest lifetime weight, which is not necessarily the set point. So that's pretty easy grading.
In fact, the numbers that I've seen are much smaller than 25% when it's extended beyond a year.
Yeah, the longer out you go and the more weight you lose, the worse the numbers get.
But the other side of this, Katie Ferraro, from what Michael's suggesting, is that maybe we do need to do more research to find out how people can keep weight off and how they can do it by some combination that actually involves willpower to some degree.
Yes, researchers are certainly interested in studying that. As Michael suggested, there are some people who succeed at weight loss, and I'm sure Sandra's familiar with the National Weight Control Registry. This is a group of what we call successful losers that researchers are interested in studying. These are people who have lost 30 pounds or more but kept it off for a year or more. And researchers look at this cohort and say, what do all of these people have in common? What is it that they're doing right, and how can we learn from them? So it's not all doom and gloom in the industry. There certainly are some highlights and things that the researchers from the National Weight Control Registry have found, that these successful losers are more likely to exercise an hour a day. Even after you reach your goal weight, you still have to work hard to stay there, if that truly is where you need to be. But they eat breakfast on a regular basis. They tend to eat more fruits and vegetables. We can learn from these successful losers and apply that at the population level and also for our practitioners to help our patients to say, look, these guys did it. Here's what helped them. Maybe this will help you.
Well, let me read some comments that are right in line here with what we're talking about and on point. Gerald writes, I think it is more correct to say that we don't work diets correctly. To say that they can't work is honey to the ears of the morbidly obese people I know who want to deny that the extent of their extra weight is bad for them, despite joint problems, diabetes, and in many cases, aortic dissection. Another listener, Galway, writes, this study doesn't show that dieting doesn't work. It shows that dieting is difficult. It may be difficult for human beings psychologically to maintain a weight, but that does not mean it's impossible, and it doesn't require a study to tell us that. If a person uses a food scale to accurately measure all of their calorie consumption, tracking their weight and lowering their caloric consumption as needed, they will lose weight. And you say what to that, Sandra Emmett?
That's a big if. If you're talking about needing to rigorously control every calorie that enters your mouth for the rest of your life, most people in practice will not do that. And I want to go back actually to something that that came up in one of those tweets, which is the correlation between obesity and health problems. That correlation exists, but that doesn't mean that obesity per se is the cause of those health problems. In fact, there are a lot of factors that are better correlated with diabetes and heart disease than obesity is. Among them, poverty, loneliness, high blood pressure, that's actually the biggest risk factor.
Big question. I'm going to go to you, Katie Ferraro.
And from, fitness.
I'm sorry.
Fitness,
yeah, please.
I want to make sure to get fitness in there.
I'm glad you did. Kristen writes, Katie Ferraro, I think a lot of people get confused between dieting versus eating right. Can you please clarify?
Yes. In our basic nutrition classes, we teach, we all are on a diet, right? A diet just refers to the foods that you eat. And you can go on a diet and go off a diet, but you have to eat every day. So as the person comments, we all are eating in a certain way. You can plan a healthful way of eating that's just the way you eat. And this takes a little bit more time. This is a long-term commitment that involves lifestyle change and behavior change, certainly exercise as well. But we all are on a diet because that just refers to the foods that we eat. And there is a positive way to put that together that doesn't involve dropping millions and billions of dollars on all the things that the weight loss industry wants you to.
And here's Haley. Haley, you're on the air with us. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
My question is about metformin. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes last year, and I've since lost 50 pounds, and I'm no longer obese, and my blood sugars are awesome. So hearing this news that I'm definitely going to gain all this weight back, and it's just a matter of time, is really disheartening. Because I feel like I want to be one of those people who doesn't. So I'm wondering if there's any studies that have been done that show that metformin can be beneficial in keeping weight off. And I'll take comments off the air.
All right. Thank you for the question. I don't know whose bailiwick this is in. Katie Ferraro, you want to handle it?
Yes, I'd love to. Congratulations, Haley, on your weight loss. And as a certified diabetes educator as well, that's just so wonderful to hear that you really associate the improvements in diabetes with weight loss. And I would argue that metformin did not make you lose the 50 pounds, that metformin was one of the therapies, along with eating less calories and exercising more, that helped you lose the weight. And when you have diabetes, when you lose weight with type 2 diabetes, your fat cells to some degree shrink in size, which basically allows your insulin to do its job better. So we teach our
students at UCSF that when you're counseling people with diabetes, you don't have to eat a certain way to make your blood sugar better. For most of our people with type 2 diabetes, more than 90% of them are overweight or obese. The best thing they can do for themselves is to lose weight, which allows the insulin to work better, which improves blood sugar control. So metformin might be an adjunct therapy, but I certainly would not cite it as the number one cause of what helped you gain weight, and it's probably not going to help you keep that weight off. The exercise, the dieting, alongside the medical therapy will probably be what's going to help her keep that 50 pounds off.
And we go to more calls. Sam, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thanks, Michael. I just had a real quick comment. It seems so simple, even though most people in our society are not supported to do this, but if people reduce or eliminate processed food, excess animal products, added salt, oil, and sugar, it seems that we gain the health benefits and our ideal weight like many other societies that don't have excess processed food, excess animal products, salt, oil, sugar. And I'm wondering what the comments are. It seems like people are making it so complicated, saying, oh, people are different. Everything. It's like, hey, how about if we just cut out that stuff and then get the benefits of people in other societies that, to American standards, are slim and healthy?
Katie Ferraro.
Sam, you're spoken like a true registered dietitian, and that's what we say day in and day out. And to be honest, that message isn't sexy, and it doesn't sell. You know, what sells is trying to overcomplicate the macronutrient mix in the supplements, and maybe you're not eating enough cabbage soup or not enough of the Beyonce cleanse. The message that you said is exactly what we teach people day in and day out. We need to eat less calories. We need to exercise more. We need to cut out all of the processed and refined junk that's so far removed from actual food. At the end of the day, if you look at the billions of dollars that the packaging processed food industry puts into advertising for their foods and then compare that to the marketing budget of the different fruits and vegetable commodity boards, it's really hard to compete because those messages, unfortunately, just aren't sexy. But at the end of the day, that's what works. The fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and you got to move more.
And let me thank the caller. I'm just wondering, though, Sandra Emmett, about how much, well, metabolism plays into this whole role of dieting or trying to lose weight through dieting. I mean, people are metabolically different, and they vary, and it's a whole continuum of metabolism, isn't there?
There is. Let me go back a second to the question that was just asked. I think I would completely 100% agree with Katie about what kinds of things cause weight gain initially. And if we could rearrange our society to have fewer processed foods and more fruits and vegetables and more exercise, people would not gain weight as easily or as often as they do. That said, weight loss is not the reverse of weight gain. After your brain has gotten used to a higher weight and started to consider it the new normal, simply reversing the conditions that caused you to gain the weight is not necessarily going to be adequate to cause you to lose it. And that's where your metabolism comes into it, because one of the things that happens once your brain has started defending a higher weight is that you lose quite a bit of metabolism and burn less energy once you get down well below that range.
Let me go to more calls. Let me go next to San Jose and welcome Mike. Mike, you're on.
Oh, thank you. So this is somewhat of a confusing conversation. Been on every diet known to mankind since I was 18 years old. I'm now in my early 60s. So that, you know, Weight Watchers, OptiFast, NutriSystems, you name it, I tried it. Yo-yoed between, you know, 200, 300 pounds for years. Got up to 400, 2005, had gastric bypass surgery. Went from 400 down to 215. Maintained that for about 5 years. But over the last 10 years, have creeped up about 10 pounds a year, back to about 270 now. So the whole idea, and one of the things that I think is missing, is, and I hate to say that people are preachy about, you know, let's change the world and fast food and that sort of thing, is the lack of, you know, we talk about metabolism, and several speakers have, but what research has actually been done is my first question. And my second question is, how do we do the Biggest Loser reunion show? Because I firmly believe, based on, you know, my doctor used to say I was the world's healthiest fat guy. The only thing I ever had wrong with me was sleep apnea. You know, no diabetes, no high blood pressure, none of that. And, you know, the explanation I heard is I have the metabolism of a sumo wrestler. I save every calorie I eat. So is there really research being done on metabolism? And thank you for your show. It's been excellent.
Well, thank you for the call. Sandra Emmett, research on metabolism?
There has been some research on metabolism. It's actually pretty tricky and complicated to do, especially if you want to look at long-term effects. This Biggest Loser study was just an amazing project that they went and measured all these people before they went on the show, right after they finished the show, 2 years later, 6 years later. I presume they're going to keep it running now. But there is some individual variability in metabolism. There's also some evidence, particularly from this most recent Biggest Loser study, that people who have dieted repeatedly, especially people who have lost large amounts of weight, still may have suppressed metabolism after they gain the weight back.
That Biggest Loser study has really changed the whole configuration of how we see weight loss. I mean, it's been almost revolutionary, but some of what I was reading about it suggests that I'm thinking about, like, the special environment that they go into. Then they leave and they go home, and somehow, you know, that just contributes to exacerbating the problems they began with.
Yeah, it's very consistent that highly motivated people go into inpatient programs for weight loss and do remarkable things. You know, they'll lose 100 pounds or 150 pounds, and then they go back to their regular lives and are confronted not only with this ravenous hunger and low metabolism that's a result of this concerted brain response that's trying to make them gain weight, but also with all the triggers and cues that are associated with eating all the things that they were eating before.
And with the stresses.
And they gain the weight back.
The stresses too, right? I mean, when
oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that plays a role. Let me get some more calls on, though. We go to Santa Rosa next. Tim, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, I was wondering, is the set point determined by your diet? Is there a different set point for a same individual if they vary their diet? In other words, I cut out all my junk food and I have a new set point different from my current diet that includes junk food.
Yeah, Katie Ferraro.
So the set point does individual, it varies by individual, and what works for you might not work for someone else. You know, take a male the same height as you, Tim. You guys likely have different set points because you have a whole different set of factors going on. But also, it's important to take into account, you ask questions about the diet, but looking at the activity level. You know, a 5'10" professional athlete is going to have a different set point than a 5'10" male computer programmer. So it's hard to say that there's one diet that precipitates a certain set point or set weight in an individual.
Let me get you on this too, Sandra, if I could.
So lifestyle changes can clearly move your weight around within that defended range, which is about 10 or 15 pounds. Whether you eat junk food or not, how much you exercise, that is definitely going to help to determine whether you're sitting at the very high end of your defended range or whether you're at the bottom of it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can change your set point itself by changing what you eat. Set points are complicated. They're set by a variety of factors, strongly influenced by genetics, but also by your weight history and a lot of stuff we don't normally think about. Your gut bacteria, whether you were deprived of sleep as a child. There's a lot of factors that come into it, but once you have a particular set point, it's pretty hard to get it to go down.
Getting a number of questions about intermittent fasting. Katie Farrell, you want to go on record on that?
Well, intermittent intermittent fasting is the notion that you eat liberally for a period of time and then you fast for a certain number of days. So there's a variety of different diets, you know, 3 days on, 2 days off. But at the end of the day, you're precipitating with any sort of these intermittent fasting programs, a period of starvation followed by a period of perhaps overeating. So I would say that in many regards with the intermittent fasting, while there is some data to suggest it may be helpful in certain populations, it's certainly not going to be an approach that's going to work for everyone, because for a lot of people, it will be continuing to mess with that metabolic rate. You're doing in a shorter period of time what a lifetime of yo-yo dieting does, which is confusing your body. Am I starving? Am I feasting or am I fasting? And it's not really a good way to approach a long-term healthful eating plan.
Well, we got a Cornhusker on the line here. Jim is joining us from Nebraska. Jim, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question has to do with the fact that I had a gastric bypass in 2002, and particularly lately, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've noticed when I eat a meal, I often crashing in terms of fatigue becoming so bad that I need to take a nap. And I'm wondering, as a second question, is there any particular mix of supplements that might tide over my eating habits so I don't have this reaction?
Yeah. Katie Farrell, can you help here?
Well, there is, as you learned in the post-bariatric situation, that there are certain nutrients that are to be avoided, namely refined sugars, because they tend to transit through the gut too quickly and cause a lot of unfortunate GI side effects. But I would suggest that, you know, we know that the nutrients that are the most satiating are things like protein and fiber. So if we can cut back on the refined sugars and add more fiber and protein from food, not from supplements. So those foods like fruits and vegetables, whole grains, legumes, they're naturally low in sugar, low in salt. They're full of fiber. And with the legumes, they're a good source of protein. That's what's going to help you feel fuller for longer, help stabilize your blood sugar, and help avoid those crashes that are leading to the fatigue that are causing you to need to nap.
And we're going to go with more of your calls and emails here momentarily, but I want to remind you that Forum is in a pledge period here. You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Katie Ferraro and Sandra Amott, and you can support this radio station. In fact, we urge you to do so and hope that you will. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Go to more of your calls, and let's go next to Rob in Sacramento. Rob, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question to you is, I wanted to bring this up as far as genetic goes. My ex-wife and I, for our whole marriage, were always a battle over food. We'd go to the grocery store. She'd buy chips, ice cream, chocolate, canned cheese. I'd buy fruits and vegetables. And I happened to notice that over time that her side of the family had a lot of overweight people, and I mean really overweight, 350 pounds, et cetera, et cetera. And it just seemed like cousins, mothers, it just seemed very prevalent on her side of the family. Of course, none of them ate healthy, but it was just really hard. None of them liked to exercise, and none of them, when you give a fresh fruit or vegetable, they would avoid it. And so we had totally different views on that, and it was really difficult in our marriage. It's one of the dividing factors. And my concern was that the children, our children, didn't grow up living off of chips and ice cream. And so it was always a battle in the house of how we're going to affect our children.
And probably not an unusual story, Sandra Amott, yeah?
Nope. So in terms of genetics, one of the things that's interesting, people like to argue that, oh, it can't be genetics because the population weight gain happened too fast. Our genes couldn't possibly have changed in that short a period of time. But we're now getting some evidence that explains that, which shows that at least some of the genes that are correlated with obesity act by affecting how susceptible people are to the modern food environment, how likely they are to eat fatty or sugary foods when they're given the choice to eat them, how low their threshold is for picking up something to eat at a time when somebody who had different genetics might not do that, how likely they are to exercise. So
this is almost epigenetics in a way, isn't it?
Well, we don't know that for sure, but it's certainly a gene-environment interaction.
And fat cells are certainly related to genetics, aren't they? I mean, they're almost tied to genetics, really, aren't they?
Pretty much everything in your body is related to genetics in some way or another.
We'll get another caller on, Ruth Ann. That's you. Welcome.
Good morning. I wanted to confirm what the guest said with a chat that when I was a kid at summer camp, we're talking 10, 11, 12 years old when girls are dieting a lot, the counselors used to always say to us, the trick is to double what you take in for food and triple your exercise, and then you'll lose weight. And that was a little bit of what you all were saying earlier.
Were the counselors right, Katie Ferreira?
Well, I think it's sad that there would be a situation where there's 11 and 12-year-old girls who are being told things about dieting. Unfortunately, that's the reality of some of our situation. But we talk about doubling the food. If we double the volume of the food and you look at high-volume, healthier foods that are like fruits and vegetables, which are high water content, they help you feel fuller for longer. I guess that could hold some truth. Tripling your exercise output kind of reminds me a lot of some of the silly government guidelines, which they told everyone exercise for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. Nobody did it. So in the next set of guidelines, they said everyone exercise for 60 minutes a day, and nobody does it. So I think tripling your exercise output would be very challenging for most individuals. So probably not the best advice out there from the camp counselors.
Well, we'll leave it there. And we thank Katie Ferraro, who is with us from San Diego, and Sandra Emmett, who's with us here in studio. And we thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.